to recap the agenda, we're going to go through reintroductions. We're going to talk about our action items, and then we have Joe and David, approving DID as a work item, and then we're going to have Joe and David present their life cycle of verifiable claims approaches and a group discussion about them. For those of you who are new, would you like to speak up? Anybody not been to our one of our meetings before and introduce themselves? Okay, we don't appear to have anybody.
No, we've
new.
Got Chris. He put himself on the queue, Chris Weber.
Oh, yeah, sorry. Chris, please go ahead.
Hey, I'm Chris Weber. I work on Federated Social Web stuff. I'm kind of only very absentmindedly participating in these calls for now since I have a lot of other work that I'm doing, but I'm kind of lurking in the background to hear what's going on.
Thank you. Well, welcome. So, could we have a anybody who's been a longer-term member who hasn't reintroduced themselves to the credentials community? Anybody want to volunteer to give for a reintroduction?
I can do that again. I just did that again in the working group, so I'll do it here. My name is
yeah.
Dave Longley.
Good idea.
I'm the CTO of Digital Bazaar, and we work on web-based payment, identity, and blockchain-related solutions. And we've been in web standards for about 10 years, and we helped to start this group, the Credentials Community Group, and the Verifiable Claims Working Group, and a number of others.
Okay. Thank you very much. So on work items. Our oldest work item is the naming options of whether or not we wish to change the name. And what we've decided to do at this point is this proposal that's in this email, which is to basically leave the name alone for now. And but we didn't want to call that final. Unless there was any, in case there were any objections. At this point, there have been no objections raised on the list. We have until the next meeting to do so. So if you have an objection to keeping the name the same and changing the charter to address the things that we wish to address, please reply on that email. We also, you know, given that, we wish to revise our mission statement. That will be a discussion in the beginning of August, which puts us behind schedule, but that's the way things are going. And then we need to make a proposal about how we're going to work with the Digital Verification Community Group. There are clearly some issues as far as bandwidth and things of that nature we have to do, but that's on hold. That's it for known action items. Are there any action items that we have missed? Okay, so I'm not seeing anybody raise anything in queue. So the next sort of discussion, which I've time boxed for about 5 minutes, could be significantly less, is that we officially take on the DID as a work item. We've had it presented. We have many champions and people implementing it. We've had no objections to the group in the group to having it as a work item. Just wanted to get last chance for it. And, the question I would have for maybe Manu or whatever is, can we do it with just plus ones here, or do we need to do it on the list, or, this is a lesser change, or is it just the chairs who say yes?
Typically, W3C process is you try to achieve consensus and let the consensus drive it, and only when it's difficult to figure out where consensus is do the chairs step in. I would suggest that we do a quick call for consensus on the call today and see how many people we have supporting it. After we do that, notify the mailing list that there's a week to object to taking the DID spec as a work item. And then if there are no objections after a week, we just pull it in and start working on it. That's the typical way you want to address kind of the addition of new work, because it results in the hardest thing to undo, after it, after you bring the work on. So no reason to rush it. I'd say let's do a proposal to adopt the DID spec as a work item for the Credential CG right now. See where, how much support we have for it here, and then make an announcement immediately after the call to the mailing list, say that we are open to objections for a week, and if there are no objections, then it's a work item that's been supported. That's typical process. It's, again, chair's prerogative to follow that.
Thank you very much. So the proposal is that we accept DID, data specification, the data model for DIDs that has been drafted by Drummond, Manu, and many others as a work item, and go ahead and put your, if you approve that, please put in plus one in the So we have 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9 if we include the one that Ryan did before the call. Okay, there it is, 9. Okay, so at this point, no objections. I will post an email to the list immediately after the call. Moving on to our main item, which is our deep dive. The idea is that we discovered when we went through sort of the possible work items review that Joe, Andrew, and David Chadwick both had interest in sort of the life cycle of a verifiable claim and sharing it. But also not so much objections from each other, but just very different approaches to how to look at the life cycle, and they may be very compatible. So what I wanted to do was to give each of them roughly 10 minutes to kind of outline, how they wish to approach the verifiable claims life cycle, maybe give us a little taste of it. So 10 minutes each of them, so that will be 20 minutes. And then sort of allow them a little bit of discussion between them about similarity and differences, and then we'll open it to a broader group discussion. Joe, do you wish to begin?
Sure. Can you hear me?
Sure can.
Hello. Okay, great. Okay, I'm going to drop in a couple links. One is to my presentation, and then one is to the Yoram paper, which is an existing model of this, and then the third is to your work, Chris, which is going to frame the use case. So my work item was I proposed doing a – hold on. Can't get my thing. Okay. Okay, so I proposed doing a identity lifecycle engagement model using verifiable claims, which is basically the approach I used with the Syrian refugee crisis that led to the Yoram 1.0.0 paper. That came out of the Rebooting Web of Trust last October, and you can look at it at that URL. Basically, the idea is that the engagement model captures the user interactions on both sides of a system. It comes from the VRM and CRM world, in that world, it was customer and supplier. Those were the two sides. For YORM, it was refugee and stewards. For the Web of Trust use case that we're going to explore, I'm not sure what the right terms are yet, but the idea is we're capturing the human requirements on both sides of sort of a complex and potentially distributed system. And we do that really without solving the underlying guts of the technology. So with YORM, we presume that there is a magical distributed data store, and there was a bracelet and a way to for YORM to moderate access and accrete an identity through that system, but we didn't get bogged down or consumed with the details of how that actually worked. So the information lifecycle has 15 stages. As I mentioned, it was derived from CRM. We added some DevOps stages. I'm going to walk through this in just a second. It's basically from before the two sides have any contact whatsoever, all the way through to when you exit the system and potentially might re-engage or return. For each of those 15 stages, you write one or two paragraphs. I think, you know, we maybe wrote three once or twice, but the idea is to keep it slim and easy to read so that at the end it reads as a sympathetic narrative, so you can get into the minds of the users, both your the hero on our side and the supporting actors on the other side of the system. And the point is to understand why they're doing what they're doing and to get a gut check about the viability of your proposed approach or the proposed system, both in terms of, you know, would they really do this and can the technology solve the problem the way that the human actors are playing it out. So the fourth slide is the all 15 stages all together. I'm going to unpack that in more detail. But I just wanted to show in slide 5 the actual two paragraphs that comprise stage 7, which is services for YORM, to give you a sample of what I'm talking about here, the level of detail involved. So stage 7 services, YORM receives a thorough medical examination from Dr. Andropoulos, who confirms the diabetes diagnosis and prescribes a daily allowance for insulin that is stored in the data store using the embedded ID in YORM's bracelet. YORM regularly visits the CAM clinic, uses his bracelet to ask for a blood sugar check with Nurse Bilali, who also gives him any necessary injections. YORM's data store verifies the prescription, and Bilali records any entry of test results and any injections. I'm sorry, records an entry of test results and any injections. And then in this case, we outline what the data records are updating since the distributed data store was sort of our magical technical architecture. So that gives you a sense of, you know, this is people interacting and doing what they need to do their jobs, and we're explaining it in the technology that's defined at sort of a straw man architecture level. So on slide 6, I zoom into the top half of the 15 stages. So stage 1 is pre-contact before they've met each other. Why are they, what are they doing, what's going to lead to the ultimate contact? Stage 2 is that contact, how does that unfold? Stage 3 we call triage, which is basically, now that we have contact, how do they figure out what they're going to do with each other? So this may entail negotiations, it may literally be triage. Depends on what the context is. Stage 4 is agreement about what we're going to do with each other. So in a sales-based scenario, which is where this came from, this would be where you sign the sales contract. So once you have the agreement for YORM, it was, yes, you're going to go to a refugee camp. Then we move into what's more traditionally thought of as the information system, and we go through a consent ceremony, create an identity record, and then move on to stage 6 and start acquiring identity information in disclosure. So that's when we do the medical intake and Nurse Bilali first hears about YORM's diabetes in that example. Okay, next slide. Stage 7 is services, which I already read. That's the normal operation of the system. Enhancements are upsells, upgrades to the system. In Yoram's case, we didn't want to give him a king-size cot because that didn't make sense, but we did give him a well-done certification that actually let him not only be useful in the camp, but also helped him get a job once he resettled in France. 9 is updates, and this is for expected changes in the record, in the data set, where typically you're going to have an interface somewhere in your app or your website or what have you. In contrast with 10, which is issues, where things go wrong in a way, you didn't build an interface for that. So it might be you need to go in and hack the database with a handwritten SQL query that's going to do some whatever. It could be a bug. In Yoram's case, there was legitimate reason to believe he might be a terrorist. And so there isn't a page in the interface to say, figure out if this guy's a terrorist. You have to figure out how to deal with those issues. 11, 12, and 13 are what I call the DevOps stages. So the first one is how do you maintain the system, the hardware, the software, the operations, how do you upgrade? 2 is migration, so this is input and output of data and transferring from one schema to another. And 13 is recovery, which I think is potentially the hardest one in the space we're dealing with, which is how do you deal with lost credentials? So maybe you reset it with the password, boom, but if you have a more complicated, harder credentialing system, you're going to need a different mechanism to do that. And then finally, 14 and 15 are exit and re-engagement. How do you get out of the system? What happens when you do leave? And is there a way to re-engage and somehow boot up back into that process? Or maybe there isn't, and that's what you would describe in your paragraphs on stage 15. So those are the 15 stages of the lifecycle. And slide 8 is a link to Chris's work. So Chris wrote up a description of what he calls a web of trust use case, which involves a first generation, second generation immigrant programmer who wants to establish a professional reputation so that she can do more interesting work and get paid better. But she needs to do so in a way that doesn't compromise her personal safety or her current workplace. So our work is to take that effort by Chris, map it to those 15 stages, get a paragraph or two in each one, make sure all 15 are covered, and make that hold together. And that's my 10 minutes. I don't know if it was 10 minutes, but that's the presentation.
Great. Thank you very much. So we'll go to questions in a couple of minutes. Let's go to the our next, which is David Chadwick.
Okay, thank you. I just put up the link to the document that I've published, so people can look at that. There is some overlap between the documents, but Joe's taking quite a different approach to the one I've taken. What I want to do, again, look at information life cycle from the position of a newborn baby rather than an immigrant, and then or a refugee, and then move on to that later. And of course, when people are born and enter the world, they have no information at all. There's no information anywhere about them. Usually, there might be information about the mother and the pregnancy, but it's not about the actual child per se. And so information has to be created. And information is created by who we call issuers in the very powerful Krenz model. So issuers create information and store information about individuals. And this information is naturally distributed because there are hundreds of issuers who issue information about you over your lifetime. And that information gets stale, and it has to be updated. Sometimes an issuer may update the information themselves because they don't have any contact with the person for a while, and so they decide this person is no longer a member of our group and they simply delete all knowledge of them. Other times the person themselves may go back to the issuer and say, look, the information you've got about me is out of date, you need to update it. And there's an issue here in the world today insofar as there's a very weak binding between the person and the information that's held about them by the issuer. Quite often all the issuer requires is for you to quote the name and address of the person, and then they'll make the changes because of it. And this, obviously, this weak binding is ideal for identity theft because in this respect you can actually pose as somebody else and get their information changed. We hope that one of the things that verifiable credentials will do is produce a much stronger binding between the individual and the issuer, so that it's much more difficult to masquerade as someone and steal that information. So I described this about the child, and there are several points I wanted to draw out which are actually on page 2. Even though the identity information is personally identifiable, and this is about a person, the person is not the source or the owner of the information. I think that's an important point. We often say this is my information. It's information about you, but you don't necessarily create it and you don't own it, and the issuer can withdraw it at their choice rather than at your choice. However, what we do want is for you to be able to control who can see it. So we want you to have control over the information even if you're not the owner as such of it. I think this is what the verifiable credentials work is doing. It's putting the holder at the center of the ecosystem and allowing them to control who can see their information, even if they are not the owner as such of the information, not the issuer of it. So number 2, each piece of information created by some organization rather than the issuer themselves. Although you can create your own information, you could become an issuer about information about yourself if you wanted. For example, I could say what my favorite color is or what my favorite food is, and I could issue that as a verifiable credential. But in general, the information I think that we're mostly interested in is information that's created by some organization or other about us. This information might be held by ourselves as a paper record, or it might not be held by us. But it will always be held by the issuer. The issuer will always have this information, and it will be held in their database somewhere, or it might even be in paper format, may not be in electronic format, but they will have the information somewhere on file. And then they will this information will need to be updated. As I said, they may unilaterally update it themselves, or they may wait for the subject to come to them and say it's inaccurate. And the final point there is there's no foolproof link that binds the person to the information, and I think this is something we would like to try and make much stronger in our verifiable credential work. So now look at an immigrant, because after reading Joe's document, I saw that was very much the focus of his document. So I thought, well, how does the typical life cycle, information life cycle of an everyday citizen apply to an immigrant refugee? And so I said, really, there's three cases here that we might want to consider. The refugee comes in and he may want to start with a completely new identity, forget all about any past identity he's had in his old country, in which case he's really like a newborn child. Or he may want to come with his identity from the other country and he may want to continue using it. So he may want to bring his passport and he may want to keep his identity and import it. So that's the second case. And then the third case, which was highlighted in Joe's story, was where you wanted to masquerade and the immigrant tried to masquerade as another person. And so I deal with that in those three cases. But I think this is not the core of what I was trying to look at. I was trying to look at your everyday citizen rather than immigrant, but you can apply the same model to the immigrant. So after looking at the information life cycle, then said, well, how does this apply to verifiable claims life cycle? And the figure 1 is not my figure. It is a figure that was published by the group some time ago. I think the figure seems to have got lost. I've not seen it recently, but it's a figure that was published by the group probably 6 months, a year ago. And that shows, this is now, we're on page, what page are we on? I've lost the page numbers. But anyway, it's figure one. It shows the hold at the center of the ecosystem. Five, is it? Yeah. Shows the hold at the center of the ecosystem that gets the credentials from the issuers, stores them in some repository. They're under his control or her control, and they present them to inspectors when they want. Now, I do know there are other use cases where credentials are going to be presented by other than the holder, other than the subject, and that isn't addressed in this document. But that's the sort of extension. I think that is the unusual case rather than the usual case. I think the normal case is where you're presenting credentials about yourself, but we can address the case where someone else is presenting credentials about me. And so there are in this particular case, there are put 9 steps for the life cycle of a verifiable credential, starting from obtaining an identifier, contacting the issuer, to get information to be issued about you, etc., down to, in the end, the credential expires and should be discarded. And finally, I look at the trust model, because the trust model is very important. Without a trust model, we really can't say much about verifiable claims, because the relying party needs to know who it can trust, what it can trust, and whether the verifiable claim is trustworthy or not. And actually, we've got a very simple trust model, which is nice. It's much simpler, for example, than federated identity trust models. And the trust model is the inspector trusts the issuer to issue the virtual credential that it receives. Okay. And then the issuer, the holder, and the inspector trust the identifier registry to be uncorruptible and to be a permanent record of identity. And that's it. One might think, well, that's a very simple trust model. But when you actually that is actually all you need. And I've said there, the issuer and the inspector do not need to trust the repository. The issuer doesn't need to trust the inspector. And that's a critical difference between verifiable credentials and federated identity management, where there's a trust relationship between the issuer and the inspector. Also, the user doesn't need to trust the repository, although we might want the user just to, because we don't want repositories to lose information or corrupt it. So the user may trust the repository so it's PC securely and to not corrupt or lose them while they're in its care. And that's the end of my document. Now, perhaps the next thing that people want to know is, well, how does this document relate to Joe's? Because they're very different. Joe's document, my reading of it, is that the user is not really at the center. He's interacting with stewards, and it's the stewards that are doing all the data manipulation, and the user has a bracelet, bracelet that actually identifies him to stewards, and then stewards will manipulate data, update data, whatever, based on this bracelet.
I think we lost you, David.
Sorry?
No, we can still hear him, or at least I can.
Yeah, I could.
Oh, sorry, did you lose me? Can you still hear me?
Yeah, we can hear you. I think it's
we can still hear you.
Okay. Well, maybe I'll stop there. Maybe people will want to question the difference in the models rather than and find out what's the overlap, what's the similarity, and what's the differences between the two documents. So I'll stop there for now.
Okay, great. Looks like Chris needs to call back in.
In the meantime, we could... Oh, there we go. Christopher,
that's
you.
Okay, I'm back. Sorry about that.
Okay.
All of a sudden, it got quiet. did David finish?
Yep, we can basically start processing the queue at this point.
Okay. So I first wanted to... before we jump into the queue, give Joe a chance to comment briefly on what he saw and maybe one last thing with David to answer that before we go to the queue.
Sure.
Joe, go ahead.
Okay. Yeah, one thing that was interesting – I like the work David's doing in terms of the more we flesh out, the bigger picture, the better. the engagement model really is focused on a single individual through a structured set, these 15 stages. So it's just one flow. So it doesn't try to explore what could be or what other possibilities there might be, and it doesn't discuss, you know, the merits of one approach or another, or what is needed in terms of, for example, David talks about a trust model. You know, that's, I think a trust model is important to what we're doing, but that's not in scope for what my document, you know, sets out to do. It just documents one thread through the experience. The other thing I do, and I don't know if it started out as intentional, but it certainly is aligned with my other conversation about identity, which is the information lifecycle is specifically not about identity. I don't talk about identities as things that are moved around. I'm focused more on information flows, which ultimately could manifest in identity, could manifest in recognition. And certainly in Yoram, we think of the data store as accreting an accretive identity layer. But there's sort of a subtle difference in the conversation there. That's all I wanted to say about what I saw as the differences based on David's presentation.
Okay. David, any last comments before we go to the queue?
So I say I saw the main difference. I think this is when you said I was cut off, was that Joe's model seemed to have the stewards who were doing the interaction with the data store, and the refugee was sort of almost a passive person who had a bracelet which allowed him to access it, but he wasn't the main act. He wasn't in the center of the world, and it seemed to me that this magic bracelet was the critical component, that without the bracelet he couldn't really do anything, and it raised all sorts of issues about how does the bracelet work, what happens if someone steals the bracelet, etc. Yeah, so I found that as a sort of a big problem with the document.
Yeah, let me address that real quick. I know we want to open the queue. So that was specific to Yoram because Yoram had nothing. As immigrant, he didn't have any technology. So with what we're doing with the Web of Trust use case, the primary user we have there will have her own devices and her own computer, so it'll be a different set of interactions.
Yeah, definitely the Web of Trust thing with Alice has a lot more agency by the subject as opposed to the refugee case. So I think that may address your concern there. Okay, so let's move to the queue. Manu, go ahead.
Right, so there were two points I wanted to make. Let me try and organize my thoughts. So I think I'm trying to figure out where all of this good work goes from a document perspective. So I think, you know, there's great energy with Joe and David Chadwick working on these things. I'm trying to figure out how to direct that energy towards, you know, a specification or architecture, you know, a set of documents that we can use on W3C standards track, right? So we can always take this work and just publish it out there as a community group item, but I think that would be bad, right? We want this stuff to become more central and core to the messaging that the folks that are involved in this group and the Verifiable Claims group are doing. So I think I see, you know, David's work feels like a big improvement on the verifiable claims architecture document that we have right now, which is very short. It's just a bulleted list. And it feels like we could effectively take the latter part, section 2 on, of David's document and make that into the verifiable claims architecture document, right? And then the architecture document could have a couple of lifecycle sections in it. I don't know whether or not that would be a good thing to do or if we want a different document for that, but let's just say there's a verifiable claims architecture document and then there's some lifecycle explanation in that architecture document. And then what we really want to do is we want to point to Joe's work, because I think Joe has done a great job of really breaking out the whole use case And the use case is very, like, it's technology agnostic. The use case is, you know, these are the things that we have to do. And I think the job that we have after we do that is to figure out what technologies are we mapping this use case to, right? To understand where the gaps are. So one of the things that you know, I saw in Joe's work is it's great. The amount of detail there is great. It really helps kind of ground it in a real world use case. My hope, and this is a question for Joe, is, you know, how are we map? Are you intending to map that to a set of technologies that we can deploy today to achieve the use case? Because I think that's a really good way of doing gap analysis, right? So we've got good gap analysis if we follow the model that you have. So it's really two questions. The question for David Chadwick is, you know, would you be comfortable with moving the document you have into the verifiable claims architecture document and making that the verifiable claims architecture document and having a lifecycle section in there, and then perhaps pointing to Joe's, entire kind of use case, detailed use case in there, which then, you know, Joe could then maybe map to which specs achieve each one of those, 15 or so steps in your use case. So in general, those are two questions I'd like to eventually hear from both David and Joe on doing something like that.
Okay. Moses, you're next.
Hi. First, I wanted to say that it's really great work. I really enjoyed reading both of them. I think what we'd like to do is take what you've done and create a I don't know if we need to bring it, do it as a use case for the entire group, but to map the needs for an ICO investor. And because they actually map pretty well, people are going to want to know, is this a hacker? They're going to want to know that they're an accredited investor. All those things map to a different world besides the third world. And it might be an interesting expansion of the use case to understand the other end of use. Does that sound okay to everybody?
Thank you. So, yeah, we can talk about that. Ryan, go ahead.
Okay, I'm off mute. And I had a question for Joe about the center of the pictorial diagram. The center of the slide is kind of a state of rest. Is that correct? Is there a name for it?
No, that actually is, it's just a visual shorthand because having all the arrows go to all the other places was more complicated.
Okay, so it's kind of a nexus that goes to all the
Yeah, it's really, well, every arrow that goes in there also goes out to all the connections. So once you get into that phase, you could go from consent to disclosure, because consent's only out arrow is into disclosure. But once you've disclosed, you might go into any of those stages. It's extremely nonlinear.
Okay. So apart from the one way into consent and out of disclosure, and the one way out to exit, then it's just a way of reducing the arrows between the others.
Correct. That's right.
Okay, got it. Thanks. So I also had a question for David about a way to search for disputes by the subject of the claim when issuers create a verifiable claim. So Equifax believes I currently live in Hawaii, but they gave me a good credit rating, so I was recently. I recently had a dilemma of wondering, you know, do I present the Equifax document to my potential landlord that says I don't live where I obviously live, or do I just accept it and just show them I do live where I obviously live in some other ways? But it would be nice if I could have formally registered a dispute several years ago saying these guys have been wrong for several years. Because I did try and correct my data, but like the website like dropped me out, and I could not figure out how to correct my data. So it would be nice if we had some way of registering these. Do we have any plans for that?
Now, you raise a very good question, actually. The issuer is the owner of the information. If they're publishing wrong information about you, that's serious. I would have liked to have thought that the data protection legislation that we've got in Europe would protect you against that, and that data controllers should not be allowed to publish false information, and you should have redress against them. And you may well have. I know there are supposed to be mechanisms by which you can correct your information with people like Equifax, and I know that the data protection legislation allows you to pay them a small fee to find out what information they've got about you and to ask for it to be corrected. I've actually paid a pound or something and got the information about myself, but I've never actually tried to correct information. And it is a good point, and I think that does need to go into the model somewhere. I think it's not a direct part of the model. It's like an ancillary component about how to correct data, just like what we might say that revocation is an ancillary component. You may or may not have revocation within the data model, but I think it's something we should talk about because it's a real issue. And if you're in control, then you should be able to A, not release that to anybody, and B, you should be able to stop the issuer from releasing false information or be able to sue them if they do.
So I feel like I do have those legal guarantees right now. And the reason I would ask that we consider this case is that when you've got an agent-mediated protocol, then it kind of makes bumping out of the agent-mediated protocol very difficult. So I was in a website that allowed me with a couple clicks to get this document to present to the landlord. And then there was a simple hyperlink to like fix your data if you dispute your data. And I clicked on it, and then things got really weird and complicated, and they wanted me to register with a new identity.
Yeah.
And so I bumped out into a different system, and that's when it was like, screw it.
Well, of course, what we're wanting to do in our work is to have limited disclosure so that you actually only disclose one piece of information. So you wouldn't be releasing URLs linking to other things. You as the center would say, look, that's my one attribute I'm giving you. I'm not giving you anything else. There is actually a corollary to this, though, and that is, which I discussed on the list some time ago, and that is if there's negative information about you, such as you've got a criminal record or you're a child molester or something like that, you're not going to want to release a verifiable claim about that. So we haven't actually got in our model about how an issuer who actually has true negative information about you might want to release that to an inspector without your permission and without you knowing about it. That isn't in the model that I've written at the moment, but it is something we need to consider.
Okay.
Because
otherwise
holders will always withhold negative information, never let inspectors know about it, even though they should.
So clearly, there's a couple of different things in this category. There is, a discussion in the verifiable claims group about, different kinds of verified claims or things people want to do with verified claims, which includes providing evidence or ratings or reputation, and then there's sort of a difference between revocation, which is done by the issuer, and maybe refutation, which is done by the subject. So we don't have language for these things. Some of it belongs in kind of the data model area. Some of it belongs a level up. you know, in specific to our community, there is a difference between a self-sovereign system and you know, and other approaches. And credentials can work both ways. I'm hoping that this community can define that there are, you know, differences between the different approaches, and, you know, sort of be advocates to the self-sovereign approach, which doesn't necessarily address, you know, the criminal record cases and things of that nature, but addresses where a lot of the different kind of harms and you know, maybe where some of the bigger problems are that aren't currently being addressed. As to these two documents or whatever, I mean, I sort of see the thing I like about Joe's document is that they're relatively short, and we need more of them. So, you know, having a Joram, having an Alice document, and then we need, self-sovereign patient John that, has agency about his health care and wishes to, engage in a process that uses verifiable claims or whatever to go through the life cycle of care. I like about his models here are that they're doable. I mean, it's basically, 35, 37 paragraphs, I guess, or so each. And then, we should come up with a name for what that's called, what those are generically called. They're not quite use cases. They're not really quite user stories. But I'd like to have a bunch of those because it really does make it easier. I know, I didn't go through all 15 steps, but I know when I actually designed the Web of Trust Bitcoin reference saying I referred to Alice's engagement model type things in order to figure out, oh, I need a step that does this in more detail. So when you actually look at the link he shared, you'll see, stuff that's very much like what it was inspired by Joe in there, but it also goes into some specifics as well. So how do we design these documents that can do both, and what do we name them and whatever, I think is an important part of our, puzzling through how to publish this stuff. Okay, Joe, you're next on the queue.
Okay, am I muted?
No, you're there.
Can you hear me?
We hear you.
Okay,
yep.
Good. Okay, so I just want to respond to Manu's question, which I think was about how we can map, or how do I see potentially mapping this work into specific technology implementations. And, it's sort of challenging. So definitely for what I'm going to be doing with Alice, it's going to be an implementation where our assumptive technology framework is what we have consensus about for verifiable claims. So it will be about issuers and holders and verifiers and how that works. However, I probably won't drive down more than that into, what kind of curves do we need, or, are there proofs, or are there two claims in a credential? Those are what I would call design and implementation choices. And the way I think about this work is it's trying to stick, and it's actually really kind of a pain in the butt as you're working on it, because it's easier to stick a design decision or an implementation decision in your narrative. But when you tease out the non-implementation elements, the human experience, the interactions, what the system needs to do in order to support the people using it, then you free up what the implementation can be and allow innovation to happen down the line. So that's sort of how I'm approaching it. I don't know if that answers your question, Manu, but that was what I was – that's how I'm thinking about it.
That's good.
Okay, next in queue.
Yeah, that's myself. I was there to also answer, I think it was Manu's question. Yeah, happy for that section 2 of my document to go into the working document. Maybe I can liaise with you offline the actual mechanics of this and how we get edit rights and things like that.
Okay, Adrian?
Hi. Yes, this was a great pair of presentations. What it leads me to ask is this too simple a model for self-sovereign identity in the following sense? In our use case, the HIE of One use case, we have three layers, and two of them are self-sovereign. The licensed practitioner is not an institution, but is part of the trust model, and obviously the patient is Alice, and she also has technology to manage her self-sovereignty. So just like we talked before, that in other words, in our software, both the practitioner, the prescriber, and Alice have mobile devices and identity containers that they control through that mobile device, and I'm not sure that the two presentations today capture that, let's call it three-layer model that includes the pharmacy, for example, or the Drug Enforcement Administration as the institutional component.
Okay, thank you.
Oh, well, I'd love to read your use case when it's finished, and then I'll see, you know, if we can adjust the model to fit it.
Okay.
Well,
so
the first version of it is out there since a year ago, and there's an update coming for this fall's rebooting Web of Trust that I'm still in process writing.
Great.
Okay, great. Just post the URL, please.
I'm going to give a final comment and then put back on my hat for closing off our hour. I think one of the key things here has to do with agency. I think maybe a lesson from this is that, you know, Joram 1.1 needs to be a little more specific about agency, you know, who's in control at various phases, even if it's, you know, almost always the issuers and not as much Joram himself, but that, you know, that can be acceptable. In the case of Alice, she has more control, you know, all the different parties, Alice, Bob, Carol, have 100% agency. There is no, it's completely consensual at all stages or whatever. And then when we talk about Adrian's example, you know, we have two parties who have agency, and then we have a third party who, you know, might be an insurer or something, you know, outside of that where there's less agency. And, you know, if we can have some way of, on one hand, there's the user story side of these things, that's the engagement model side of these things, and then there's these, given that engagement model, you know, how might we do this in a variety of different mechanisms, whether or not it's through DIDs or a centralized data store or whatever can be done. So to close out my comment, agency, I think, is maybe one of the key things we need to be in all of these documents that we're working on. So I'm not sure yet that we have a work item design or whatever such that, you know, it's ready for the whole community to pitch in on. I think that I would encourage Joe and David and Adrian and whoever else to continue to kind of evolve these and see, you know, how they'll fit in. To address Manu's question, is this ready to, are these ready to, you know, put as group work items that we can, you know, move on to a standards track or whatever, not quite there. So, but I want to keep track of these activities and encourage them, and I plan to participate. This is the end of our 10 o'clock Pacific time for this call. Next week, we're going to be closing out name and begin and try to see if we can make some progress on our mission statement. That'll probably be about half the meeting. Is there anybody who wishes to share a bit about their proposed work item progress, or are there any particular requests for next week? So nothing at this particular point, but if you have a specific request or wish to present, please let us know. That would be, put it on the list. The final thing that we're going to do is if there are people that wish to hang around for discussion on DIDs, we're going to close the meeting at this point. But there are a couple of, it's going to be probably for the next couple of months, we're going to be taking at least a few minutes after the meeting to discuss some DID specifics in sort of a stand-up, agile way, if people want to hang around for that. So, otherwise, we'll just go ahead and close this session. And thank you very much for joining us. We'll have another session next week.
Cool.
Thanks, Christopher.
Thank you.